New job? Growing family? Need a change of scenery? When life gives you a reason to move, start with Open Door. Request a cash offer in minutes. No prep work or showings needed. Or list with us and test the market with the cash offer to fall back on. You choose. Sell your way at opendoor.com. That's opendoor.com. Terms and conditions apply. Open Door Brokerage LLC and Open Door Brokerage in California DRE 020-611-30.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
I'm joined by Alva Smith, activist and campaigner, Kevin Doyle, group head of news with independent newspapers, and Ursula Savage, political commentator, and I should be clear, no relation, although the Savages live in a very small gene pool, so somewhere along the line there may
somewhere,
be a relation.
Go back far
somewhere. Now, we were talking before the break to Cathal Berry, the former commandant in the Irish Army Ranger Wing, about the situation we find ourselves in now that America has decided it is no longer the global policeman. Alva, the French president calling a meeting on Monday, and an obvious implication of that meeting is going to be a call for a greater militarization across Europe. I assume that is A, something you would not normally want, but B, is it something you see an alternative to?
Well, I mean, it is very interesting. First of all, I should say it's not absolutely clear who has been invited to attend this meeting. So we're told that it is European leaders. And certainly the papers have people like Meloni, Tusk, Scholz, who will not be there for very much longer.
Do me a favour, just pull that microphone just in front of you.
There for very much longer because the elections in Germany are next week.
And this is in part because it is sort of leaked from participants rather than being an official formal announcement.
Exactly. It seems to have come from Sikorski, who is the Polish foreign minister. Now, let's also make the point that the foreign ministers, the EU foreign ministers, are going to be meeting in Munich next week in any case to focus on the recent declarations. Declarations, I think it's about, I don't know, crazy. But so it's not really clear. Macron obviously wants to get people together. He's also apparently including the UK and Denmark. So is Ireland going to be part of this? That isn't anywhere that I can see. It would be a very difficult one,
I think. The greatest of respect to us, have we a role at this table?
Well, I was going to say it would be a difficult one for us anyway, one way or another. And our contribution to the conversation might not be of any great importance. I mean, you know, partly this is Macron's bid for power once, because, of course, there is now the breach, if you like, in Germany. So Macron is making his big move. So I feel very cynical about it, to tell you the truth. I can see that there is a lot of politicking going on here, and Macron reaching out his fist and pulling European leaders in seems to me to be his moment when he says, well, I'm the person now, I'm the one who leads Europe.
Can I ask, Alva, at this point,
who makes the,
even if the intent might be, or even if the motivating factor might be personal ambition or political ambition,
yeah,
somebody needs to do it, doesn't it? I mean, when we have J.D. Vance meeting with the leader of the far right in Germany, when we have the U.S. vice president attacking the entire bloc on unfounded basis and misinformation, somebody has to step up.
Europe has to step up. The European Union has to step up. My point is that it is not for Macron to go and seize the power, but that's what politics is about. So that is exactly what he is doing. And I think it behoves us to look at what the European political underpinnings are to this, and to ask ourselves quite seriously, is there a genuine commitment in the first instance to actually doing whatever it might take to ensure that Ukraine doesn't lose any territory to Russia? And I don't think that there is that desire in Europe at the present time. I don't see it coming from anywhere. And I think, therefore, that this is about something else. This is about trying to stand up to Trump. It is not necessarily about the protection of Ukraine. And I think that Zelensky, it seems to me, in what he has been saying, is very well aware of that. And he is basically saying, look, you need to put your money, all of you in Europe, on the table. I actually feel that Ireland should keep well out of this. If we are a neutral country, and if we're going to safeguard our neutrality, which I happen to believe we should do, this is not directly our business.
Neutrality doesn't have to mean cowardice, though, does it?
Of course not. I don't think that that is necessarily cowardice at all. I don't think that neutrality is cowardly. But I do think that what we have to say to ourselves is that people, countries around the world now have to stand up and say, just stop wars. And that is not about saying we will give Putin whatever he wants. We have to, I think, as people, actually really take over a different kind of conversation, have a conversation which is, I suppose, much more about the morality and immorality of war. But I know that that is not the the realpolitik of the situation at the present time. And actually, it just, like many people, I think I find it very distressing to think of what is happening. I think ultimately what's going to happen is Ukraine is going to lose some of its territory to Europe. I don't think Europe will stand up. What I would really, really, really want to see Europe standing up and doing at the moment is actually taking on the plight of Palestinians, and that it is very significantly not doing.
OK, well, let us stay for a while with Ukraine and with the issue in terms of the sort of shift of power across the globe. Kevin, you know that A Few Good Men line, the living under the blanket of freedom that I provide and questioning the manner in which I provide it. We have been living under a blanket of American military protection, unquestioningly in large part. Is this now the point where we have to go, we can no longer rely on that?
Well, it seems that we can't sit on our hands anymore. What that exactly that means, I'm not sure, because, you know, Alva talks about that our focus should be to end all wars. But the truth of it is, if you look at the situation here, the only way it seems that this war, a particular war, is going to end is if Europe stands by and lets Russia take part of Ukraine, because Russia clearly now has Donald Trump on side. And I wouldn't be surprised if in the next few weeks we saw a meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, which would be quite the thing.
When you think back over the
last few years in particular, that is where we're now ending up, that he is siding with them. And meanwhile,
carving up European territory without the involvement of the EU.
Of Europe. I mean, his special envoy has effectively said there is no place for Europe in this at all. It's not going to happen. It's in the school of realism, I think, is the phrase that the American officials are using to kind of, Europe has no part in this discussion, which is bizarre. And so you ask, where do we fit in Europe then? So Europe no longer fits in this discussion. And where are we? And, you know, the Sunday Times had a headline about Harris and Martin both talking about us needing to up our spending on defence. There's a realpolitik in that as well. So we talk a lot about how we rely on the RAF to protect our skies, and we don't have enough crews and money to send our ships out to patrol our waters, and how really we are somewhat isolated from all of that. And at the same time, I feel that for a long time, the politicians see not a huge amount of benefit in spending money on our defence forces. So we love, I suppose, the ceremonial part of our defence forces, but they don't necessarily want to spend the money on that, but when also, it can be spent on hospitals or schools or anything else that you
and
can get
elected with.
And
also realistically, the amount of money that we could spend on radar and AI and so on to keep, it's basically about the coastlines, I think, isn't it? It's absolutely minuscule by comparison with what might very well be required. So, I mean, it seems to me that that would be just throwing money away into the ocean.
But do you not make the same argument?
Because
can you not flip the environmental argument? Hang on for a second. When everybody talks about the environment, what they say is Ireland is too small to make a difference, therefore we shouldn't bother. And the response is always, no, we have a role to play and an example to set and to show that we are part of the club. Is the same not true in terms of mutual defence?
Well, it certainly can be, but that's a somewhat different question to the one we were talking about just now. Should we actually spend more money on defences? No, we should possibly spend much more money on beefing up other things and on looking after, you know, our own infrastructure here. But for us to be spending money on developing our radar, it is not in the interests of either the UK or Europe as a whole to have, you know, Russia invading Europe via Ireland. Those defences are going to be put, they are already actually working and in place. What we can do is so little in that regard, practically, concretely, materially, on the ground, in the ocean.
We have a huge amount of pipelines and fibre optic cables that run in and out of Ireland.
Yes, but again, I mean, you know, that is funding.
We have a huge amount of airspace
from the European Union. Our beefing up our defence spending, which is, I think, very, very low at the moment. What's about 2% or
yeah,
even
it might
less?
Be less than that. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Is
when others talk in the region of 5, 6, 7%.
You know, I just don't think, I think it's neither here nor there. The question about our being small, but that we can be morally very fierce. Yes, I think we can. I think we absolutely can. I'm not sure that that is something that we need to do or that we can do.
The one counterpoint I meant to make to Alvedo is in the European context that you're looking at now, and you listen to Trump talking about whether other countries pay their fair share to NATO and all the rest of it, there will a point come, and it perhaps has already come behind closed doors, where the rest of the EU is looking at Ireland going, but your guys are not bothered. Don't come over to us, to our meetings on security and looking for...
Lecture us for high-minded...
Yeah, and the moral position holds nothing if you're not willing to put in the same as the rest of us. It, as the debate, as Zelensky has kind of gone around, should there be an EU army? Look, that debate has been going on for decades, but it's back on the agenda, no doubt. And Ireland will ultimately oppose that, you would imagine, given our neutral position. And
so
that's where I think the rest of Europe will start to go, right, lads, do you know what? Just don't bother being in the room. And then you can take your morals where you like.
What about the relationship with the States, Ursula? Because that's the other thing in all of this. J.D. Vance's speech, where he used, I mean, a complete mischaracterization of reality and in some instances outright lies to attack Europe to its face and to suggest, I mean, his phrase was that the problem is from within, and to start this whole culture war stuff again about prayer and all the rest of it. There is a time when the notion of an American vice president doing that on European soil would be completely anathema.
There would have been, of course. And I think this entire conversation is just showing that so much of what was almost a given about international diplomacy and international relations between Ireland and other countries and then Europe and the US and even further afield, the rule book's been thrown out the window entirely. And I think that that really does leave everybody saying, like, well, what is the situation going to be from now on in? And we knew as soon as Donald Trump was elected back in that there was going to be a very, very different sort of style coming this year and for the next 4 years as well. And we're seeing that play out, and there was so much speculating happening, but now we're seeing in the weeds kind of how that's manifesting. And what Sikorski, the Polish foreign minister, a phrase he used, and I think it does apply to this thing as well, is the phrase he used for how Trump operates is Razvedka Boyum. Now, I'm not going to say that I did not butcher that phrase there now, but it means reconnaissance through battle. In other words, they'll try anything they can, they'll get away with what they want, they'll keep pushing and keep pushing until people start pushing back.
Reconnaissance through battle.
Reconnaissance through battle. And I think it's an interesting phrase because that's what they're doing. They're not worried about how things are going to play out. They're not worried about what the consequences of their actions are because they're just going to try something else. If this doesn't work, we'll push something else. So if he wants to, J.D. Vance wants to come to Europe and rile up the right and meet with who he wants and try to start this culture war, he's actually not that bothered if it works out or not, because if not, they'll come in and they'll try something else and they will keep going and they will keep pushing because the shackles are completely off them now.
And we're at the start of four years. Think of everything that happened this week alone
exactly.
in Trump land.
And they're not thinking about re-election.
There's a headline in one of the papers this weekend that says Ireland is going to end up in the lead position on EU tariff negotiations with the EU if ever there is a poison channel.
Well, if we sorted that out, maybe they'd
But I think what was so interesting all week is that swaggering arrogance that we are to be ruled now by overlords. Mm. I had this, you know, this sense of these, particularly Putin and Trump, with their acolytes and allies, like your man, swaggering into the European Union. And just thinking, this is a completely horrendous world global takeover. And of course we all have to stand up, Anton. Of course we have to do what we can. But talking about increasing our defence budget from 2% to 2.5% is really not actually going to achieve very much. And will we do a lot better building a few houses for people right now?
The front page of the Irish Mail on Sunday has a story related to Gráinne Seoighe, and it's on the foot of a letter that she wrote to Micheál Martin. Now, you'll remember that Gráinne Seoighe was the candidate replacing Éamon O'Caoimh in what was formerly his constituency. And there was a big sense that given the level of fame that she had, she was going to romp home. It turned out not to work out that way. But in the letter that the Irish Mail on Sunday has printed, she talks about the kind of damage that was done to her by this dalliance in politics. And they have reprinted a large chunk of the letter that was written in, I think it was written to Fianna Fáil Secretary General Sean Dorgan, asking for her to be made a senator. Because you'll remember Alison Cumann was one of the other significant celebrity candidates that ran for Fianna Fáil, did very well, I think just barely missed out on the seat, or was the next in line, and therefore looks like a good electoral prospect, particularly if they split the constituency in Leith. She got made a senator, Grainne didn't. Here is what Grainne's letter printed in the Mail on Sunday said. As I am sure you'll have seen in the national media, there continues to be a disproportionate focus on my campaign since Election Day. And whilst I accept that it did not go the way I would have liked, I think it has been most unfair. Putting myself forward as a candidate has had a very real impact on me, my career and my income. TV work and MC events, which regularly would have been given to me, have either been cancelled, not renewed because I stood, or in some cases, no reasons provided. At the time of writing, I do not have one gig, either TV or MC, booked in for this year. This has never happened to me before. As you can see from my letter to the Taoiseach, I am keen to continue to play a role in public life, and I believe I can contribute richly in this regard. I would appreciate your support for one of his likely Taoiseach nominations to the Seanad. And she goes on to say that I was hopeful I could arrange to meet you over the coming weeks and might discuss my political career, but to address what might counteract the very real impact running as a candidate has had on my career and income, and fundamentally is not something any high profile candidate who declares for public politics should experience. Now, Kevin, is that evidence of naivete, or is that evidence of a rot at the core of politics and reasons that women particularly don't run?
I have to say, I have some level of sympathy for Grainne Shoigi, but ultimately that letter speaks to naivety, I think. She was a very high-profile candidate going into this. She has worked in the media for years. She would have known and expected that she would get a disproportionate amount of coverage, that the TV cameras and the newspapers would all arrive down into Spittal to do a focus on how is she getting on with the real people in the West. So
as much as she got...
Yes,
this
program absolutely
paid a lot of attention to her, much more than we did out of any one independent candidate running for a first time.
Absolutely, because everybody in the country knows her. So she's not just running in Galway West. She is now a public face of Fianna Fáil, as it was, as the party she picked. I mean, she got on the ticket relatively easy, without any years of toiling. Normally how you get to be on the ticket is you work in the grassroots, you become a councillor, you run for a general election at that point. So she bypassed all of that. Would that have just happened if Mary Murphy had put her hand up and said she wanted to replace Eamon O'Queeve, one of the longest standing members of the party, with a huge history in Fianna Fáil?
Quite the DNA.
Yeah, it wouldn't have. So... you know, there are benefits to the profile that she took advantage of, and the letter suggests now that she is not liking the fact that she didn't get a seat, and I suppose the fallout from that. So look, it is tough. There is no doubt that when you put it
but even if you're in the media, you cover politics and have done for a very long time. Does the fact that you're in the media properly prepare you for just how torn up you get during a political campaign?
Well, we've seen in presidential elections particularly, and when you're high profile, it can feel a little bit like a presidential election. So no, it doesn't. We have seen so many people fall by the wayside. I mean, the obvious one in the past was the George Lee dalliance with Fine Gael, where he arrived into Leinster House, discovered that he wasn't going to be the Minister for Finance, and quickly hightailed it back to RTE.
And that's how you summarise that journey into politics.
Yeah, he didn't. I mean, he's well on the record. He didn't enjoy his time in Leinster House. He discovered that being a backbench TD actually has very little influence, and it can be quite.
But he was electorally successful.
To be. Oh, he was in a by-election, bounced in, but bounced out as fast.
But I think there is another dimension to this. I mean, I am with Kevin on this. In fact, I do feel some sympathy for Grainne Shoigi. I do think being very well known, and particularly as a woman, and particularly as a quite a young woman with a very attractive personality and so on and so forth, does actually tend to bring unwanted attention on you. However, I think it also demonstrates that political parties picking out certain people as so-called celeb candidates is really a sort of sleight of hand. That is the political parties trying to do trying to have more women on their slates when it actually comes to election times, instead of putting in the hard work and the funding, the money that it costs to actually develop good women candidates from way back when they're, you know,
but
whatever.
Fianna Fáil would say, we point to Alison Cumming's electoral success. She was pipped at the post. She didn't make it. She's now in the Shannon and she's a good shoe in
Sometimes celeb candidates work and sometimes they don't. It's worked for other political parties. Fine Gael notably has had some success in this. But that does not really, I think, address the fundamental problem of the huge gender imbalance that continues. I mean, still only 25% mm-hmm. of women in Dáil Éireann. So, you know, there is a major problem here and it is not going to be solved by political parties plucking out this, that or the other woman and running them as their candidates.
One thing... hang on, Kevin, back to you in one second. Ursula?
Just kind of to add to your point there too, I do think it kind of shows as well that being a politician is, at the end of the day, a job that requires a very specific skill set. And strangely, sometimes the skill set required to act as a politician isn't the same skill set that's needed to be a very good campaigner. And so perhaps even if, say, if Grainne Shoy had run a fantastic campaign, as George Lee did back in the day, he ran a great campaign and he whilst in no problem at all, didn't mean he had maybe the skill set and the temperament that was going to make him good for that role as a politician. So whenever the selection conventions are happening, whenever they're choosing somebody, yes, you want somebody high profile. But just being high profile, and say if we were in a different...
Cannon fodder, Ursula, you need bodies
say
quickly.
Say that Grainne Shoy's campaign had gone well and she was sitting in the Dáil now. Because you're a high profile person, because you're good at public speaking, because you're good at that, does that actually mean that you're going to be a good politician? Or do parties need to look at when they're doing the selection conventions and when they're looking at filling their quotas with women that they're going to put in electable seats, which is something that I think if we look back to some of the candidates, the female candidates that were put in some constituencies, it'd be questioned about whether or not they actually thought they were ever going to have a chance. I'm not saying that's what happened in this case at all, but they need to look at what are the skill sets that's actually needed in that instance.
Just final point on this one, Anton, because the content of the letter is one thing, but the real reason I think it's naivety is that the letter had to be written in the first place. That deal should have been done at the beginning. You go to Micheál Martin, you say, do you want me to be your celebrity candidate? I'm going to take punches here that other candidates won't. Well, look, if it doesn't work out, you know yourself what you need to do for me. And that should have been done at the start. And that's the realpolitik, is that other people would have been doing deals like that months ago before the election. And obviously, Grainne Shoy,
You have to sort of be in politics and be politically experienced to know, Kevin, that that's what you need to do.
Parachute
before you jump.
Yeah. Oh, well, yes. I mean, but she didn't. She didn't know to do that. And I think it's getting that experience.
Well, we don't know, but it's just, sorry, just to come in there. But even if a deal like that had have been done, Alison Cumming was sixth in a five-seater. Grainne Shoy was ninth in a five-seater. And if, you know, we select, and there's a lot.
A deal is done, Ursula.
But is it though? Nothing's agreed, everything's agreed.
Can I ask one thing on it? The bit about the work drying up, is it reasonable that that would have been predicted? Because that seems to be, like, it is actually desperately sad when you read it. This is somebody who took, which is a very brave thing to do, who put themselves forward for election, and at the end of it discovered, A, they didn't succeed in getting an election, but they have paid a huge economic price for it. Was that naivete to not expect that?
I think it's difficult. She obviously, you don't go into these things expecting to lose, I suppose, but you should probably plan for that eventuality. I mean, it's tough. Virgin Media had to pull, they had filmed a whole TV series with her, Grainne Shoy and Traw, which was due to go out around the time that her candidacy was announced. So, you know, I can imagine there are some executives in Virgin Media feeling a bit burnt by the fact that they couldn't then put that out in the midst of an election campaign. So, you know, you kind of have to go in with your eyes open. And that may wear off over time. It probably will, in fact. And there'll be a second coming for her, I imagine. But right now I can see, yeah, it must personally be very tough.
Well, I do think it's really important also to say to, you know, particularly I think of it about women, pick yourself up and go again, because that's actually what you have to do in politics.
That's Alva Smith, campaigner. That's Kevin Doyle, Group Head of News with Independent Newspapers. And that is political commentator Ursula Savage. And over in London, that's Henry McKean, who is live from London, because tonight the BAFTAs are taking place. Anywhere there is a nice red carpet gig, Henry finds himself. The Irish hopefuls, of course, Saoirse Ronan is in there. Kneecap is in there. Henry, what can we expect?
Anton, yeah, it's very exciting over here in London. Good morning from London. Yeah, fresh from winning two IFTAs, Saoirse Ronan. She's up again, nominated for leading actress for her role in the addiction recovery drama set out there in London and in Scotland, out in Orkney, The Outrun. Kneecap also, they're up for six nominations tonight. The writer-director Rich Pepiat, his biopic of this Belfast rap group, has had an amazing year. So it's outstanding debut, original screenplay, casting, film not in the English language, editing, and also outstanding British film, because there is British money behind this film.
Sorry, let me get this straight. Kneecap might win outstanding British film.
That is exactly it. It does have some British money, and obviously the writer-director is English himself. So, but they could actually be pipped by Conclave. They could win heavily tonight. This is a movie about choosing the next Pope, starring Ralph Fiennes and Stanley Tucci. It really is brilliant. It's a fantastic kind of, basically hairs on the back of your neck stuff. I just watched it, and it's brilliant. Also, Brutalist. The Brutalist could clean up. This is a kind of a Second World War, end of Second World War movie about the Jews surviving the Holocaust and a visionary architect. But it's 3 hours, 35 minutes long, so most reviewers haven't seen it. I have seen it. Has an interval. It's brilliant. Adrian Brody could win big for that. And also Demi Moore. This could be a career highlight for her. If she gets the BAFTA, she could go on and get the Oscar for The Substance. Brilliant, brilliant movie. And it's about...
Did you watch The Substance, Henry?
I have. Loved it. Absolutely loved it. Have you seen it?
Yes. Never have the wheels more... Act 3 of The Substance is just astonishingly dismal.
Well, I mean, it's very graphic. It's very...
That's a term.
There's lots of gore, there's lots of blood, but it's also a dark comedy about where we are as human beings. I absolutely loved it. I thought it was fantastic. And I definitely think Demi Moore is going to be, hopefully, chatting to me later when she wins.
Henry, thank you very much. That is Henry McKean, who's heading to the BAFTAs. He is in London as we speak. And of course, he's going to be on air tomorrow, reporting back on all the winners and losers from tomorrow morning on News Talk Breakfast onwards. And of course, the BAFTAs on ITV, or rather on BBC One tonight from 7 p.m. Interesting story, Kevin Doyle, on the front of your newspaper, one of the staple of newspapers for which you are significantly responsible. Principals have, this is one of the rare moments that a social media company has done something helpful. Google are pulling the reviews of schools from their site.
Yeah, and as someone who's recently spent a lot of time looking at schools, because my little one is just of that age, I didn't realise this was a thing, but apparently on Google you can review schools in the same way that you can review restaurants or hotels. Or
what could go wrong?
What could possibly go wrong? So yeah, you know, the classic kind of, Mrs. Egan is not a great Irish teacher at all. Now, she only has a couple of fuckle kind of stuff going on. And it sounds kind of funny because you can imagine the kids going in and writing some less than complimentary things about their least favourite teachers. But actually, the point that the Association of Principals and Deputy Principals is saying is that it's actually quite a serious thing, because in that Wild West that is the digital space, I guess, you know, we would never put something in the newspaper. You would never say anything on this radio show, Anton, that would risk defamation. But all day, every day, stuff is published online that is defamatory. And they pointed to one case where an allegation was made about a teacher and it fell under child protection. And as a result, the teacher had to basically step back from their job because the school couldn't just go, that's just someone writing rubbish online. So the teacher had to be subject to investigation based on somebody just putting something on Google. So there's actually quite a serious thing to it. I think most people listening, their race will probably might run to what they write about their teachers, but that must be unreal stress.
So Google will no longer be doing it.
They're going to remove what's there and they're going to no longer accept them, yeah.
While we're talking social media and its capacity to fame, to defame, of course, at the absolute pinnacle of that is X. Bit of positive news in relation to X. Ursula, Elon Musk, the X owner, who is now also in charge of auditing the federal departments that give him billions every year into his various different companies. He's a dad again.
Happy news for him, isn't it? Just number 13, baby number 13. So, where do you begin with this, really? But Elon Musk apparently has said at one stage is that he believes that falling birth rates are more of a threat to the globe than global warming. So he has made it his mission to repopulate the Earth. So that
would that was a joke. He has said this.
He has said that.
But his part not by that creating 13 babies.
He's playing his part in repopulating the earth. That's why he's had 13 children so far. And what the article said too was that, you know, the man's only 52. We could go on having children for another 30 years. So here comes child number 13. He's not that involved, I don't think, with the older children that he has, but he's very much so involved with the younger children that he has, in that his four-year-old, who I'm going to call X, which is the shortened version of their name, but he takes him into the Oval Office with him all the time.
I'll see if we can get this right. X-Ash, Archangel 12.
I'll take your word for it.
Nobody is going to just...
No. But he's in the Oval Office now, the four-year-old, and probably one of the more sensible people in that room now, let's be honest. But it was a great clip during the wake of him telling Donald Trump to shush, you know.
Well, I mean, at one level, it is Elon Musk's own business, how many children he has and with whom he has them and so on, and big families. I mean, my mother was one of 11 and
family
all that kind of thing.
Loose term so in this instance, Alva, I think.
What is deeply, deeply, deeply worrying, and I think must have been found very concerning by people who opened up their newspapers the other day and saw the photograph of Musk with his baseball cap and his very small little fellow beside him there in the White House, telling Trump how to run the world, which is quite clearly what Trump is embarked upon at the moment. And I think that everybody felt, but this person, Musk, whether he has 13 or 14 or 15 or 100 million children, was not elected to do anything at all in American politics. He has never put himself forward for election. He happens to be the owner of an incredibly powerful means of communication. But that, to me, was, I mean, profoundly distressing and upsetting.
Oh, and when you look at that Venn diagram, owner of a powerful means of communication, owner of companies in receipt of billions of dollars of federal funding, while auditing the federal government's federal funding,
absolutely,
while not being
and telling people and telling people to retire, people who, by the way, also have children and families and whatnot, and who are now going to be deprived of their living by Musk.
Alva, thank you. Alva Smith, activist and campaigner, Ursula Savage, political commentator, and Kevin Doyle, group head of news at Independent Newspapers.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.